Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 24th of October. Domestic violence this hour of the program. We awoke again on Sunday morning to a horrible rampage at a salon and spa in Brookfield, Wisconsin. We'll have three guests with us this hour to talk about domestic violence. John Diedrich of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is with us. He's been doing reporting, including a very compelling story on the front page of today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at why this deadly rampage came after years of what he calls sidestepping Brown Deer police on domestic violence incidents, including a January 2011 confrontation when officers saw him point what looked like a rifle at his wife, but then did not arrest him. We'll look at the issue of domestic violence. It's amazing how many calls Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee receives every year related to domestic violence. Why is it still so prevalent in our society? We'll speak with the director of Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee, and we'll also be joined by a domestic abuse survivor this hour. We'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, and you can send messages on our Facebook page if you would like to do that, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kathleen. Happy to be here.
This was a long history of abuse reports, and your story about the January 11 when the police walked away from a man in the window who appeared to have a gun is just incredible that nobody was arrested as a result of this and brought to jail.
Exactly right. You alluded to the long history. This starts at least back in 2000 in a suburb that is adjacent to Brown Deer. 2003, this couple was in Brown Deer. This is the Houghton couple, Zena and Radcliffe. Between 2003 and this year, there were at least six cases where the Brown Deer police went to the home. Domestic violence incidents of some sort, verbal or more violent, if you will. No arrests made in any of those. And you alluded to the January 2011 incident. We spoke to experts yesterday. They're just completely flabbergasted by the Brown Deer Police Department's response here. What happened was the police came to the scene on a report. It was a very frantic call from Zena Houghton, and she said, hurry up, send help, you know, in an urgent way. They got out there. She began to backpedal off her story, which is not uncommon, and you can speak to your experts about that, but we understand this is not uncommon for victims to backpedal or to apologize, if you will, or try to deter the police once police are on the scene. As police were talking to her, though, they saw Mr. Houghton, Radcliffe Houghton, point what appeared to be a long-barreled gun out the window at her, who was standing 3 feet from them. They set up a perimeter in response to that. During that time that they had the perimeter set up, they saw him stand near a window with what appeared to be a handgun in his hand. They drew weapons, told him to drop the weapon. He refused. He withdrew from the window. They even put him under arrest with a bullhorn, orally telling him he was under arrest. And then inexplicably, after 90 minutes, they withdrew and basically retreated from the scene. And experts have just raised all sorts of questions about this, and we really haven't gotten an explanation other than a short press release from the Brown Deer Police Department.
How will you get an explanation?
Well, we're asking every day the Brown Deer Police Chief to come out and speak about this. Steve Rinsel has not spoken publicly. I've contacted municipal officials in Brown Deer. What they've said is they've said in this release, again, that was issued Monday, they said, well, you know, he was alone in the home. Experts say you don't know if he was home alone because you never went in. They said, we don't know if it was a weapon. The experts we spoke to said certainly there was probable cause. The officers on the scene responded as if it was a weapon. And that's enough to know. And until you go in, you don't know if it's a weapon. And finally, in the press release, they said that the victim said there weren't weapons. And again, the experts say this is not uncommon for a victim on the scene. And they just said this is really out of step with the way police respond, not only to domestic violence, but, a standoff situation, that really police are the last line of protection, you know, for neighborhood and victims and so forth. They don't come to this level and then withdraw.
He was supposed to have surrendered his weapons. What's the procedure for doing that? Did he do that? And the second question is, how did he get the gun that he was used?
Well, you're alluding to the restraining order that came after all these missed opportunities by law enforcement to hold him accountable. Zena Houghton went to court in Milwaukee to get a restraining order. That was granted, a four-year restraining order. Just last week, on Thursday, a four-year restraining order was issued. As standard language in that, he was supposed to surrender his weapons. He did not, though we don't have evidence that he owned a weapon when that restraining order hearing happened, despite the fact that there's some reports of this long gun and so forth earlier. He had no weapons when they searched his home. However, what he was able to do is purchase a gun on Saturday. And the way that works is federal law says when you're under indictment for a domestic violence incident, you're prohibited under federal law from buying a firearm. So if he had gone to a gun store, he would have been flagged. They would have said, can't buy it. And there also would have been a 48-hour waiting period for a handgun. The way he worked around that, the way he sidestepped, if you will, federal law on that is private sales. Person-to-person sales are not covered. Federal law is not covering that particular sale. So he bought, we don't know who the individual was, but he bought a firearm, a 40-caliber handgun from a private citizen. No background check was done. No 48-hour waiting period was done. This was 2 days after the restraining order hearing. The restraining order was issued. And then just the next day, he killed his wife, two other women, and wounded four other women at the spot.
Do you know if she had sought help from any organization that helps women who are victims of domestic abuse?
We know from the reports that she was referred to a couple different shelters, that she was referred at one point to Sojourner Truth House. And I know that Carmen Petrie is going to be on the radio later talking about their facility. There also was a facility in Waukesha where she was referred, the sister house, and that was after he slashed her tires. There's a couple of very serious incidents that happened earlier this month, and in response to that, she was referred to those agencies. It's interesting reading the reports in that all through the reports, she's really denying the abuse is happening. At one point, she said way back in 2000, she was claiming that she tore her own clothes. They found her October 2nd, just 3 weeks ago, with a bruised face. She claimed it was her makeup running. So she denies it over and over again. But then in the restraining order hearing, all the cards are out on the table, if you will. She's very candid. The audio is very chilling. She says on the audio, I'm very fearful of him, and you know, and I don't want to die. And it's very compelling. And again, what the experts are telling us, and I'm sure yours in the second hour can talk about this, second half hour, is, you know, this is not uncommon for somebody to reach out for help, but only go so far and then leave it up to law enforcement to say, hey, can you guys? And that's what experts are telling us, is that's why the law does not say we're going to dismiss the case because the victim doesn't want us to proceed. Law has been, you know, crafted with this very scenario in mind, that you may have an uncooperative or even lying victim, that you have to work past that and see what's in front of you and take action accordingly. But the message, according to these experts, are that he was emboldened by this. He was emboldened by law enforcement's basically cowering away from him as he was increasingly more brazen and violent.
Mm-hmm. And from what you, I'm sure, know too much about these kinds of incidents throughout the country, is it unusual for somebody to take out this horrendous action on other people as well, to go to a very public place? We've heard about other incidents at hair salons, actually, in California and other places, and kill other people?
It does happen. You know, there's scenarios in domestic violence where it happens just in the home, where just family members who happen to be around might be affected. In this case, what's interesting is he had committed an act of violence and vandalism at that facility just a few weeks earlier. That's what the tire slashing happened at the spa. And there was a sense that she, from what we're hearing from her coworkers, that she was getting a sense of support from the people whose hair she cut, her coworkers. She was confiding in them about the problems that, you know, if you will, it sounds like that had become a support center for her. And it was unclear where she was staying at the time that this happened. happened. Brown Deer police, rather than taking to her shelter after one of these incidents, dropped her off at a hotel. But we don't know where exactly she was staying right at the time of the shooting. So it could be that he went to this location simply because he knew that she would be there, that because of the no contact order, that was the location he would find her. And again, from the reports that we're hearing, it was a very chaotic scene. There was a lot of efforts, heroic efforts on the part of victims and so forth to stop him, to get in the way. At one point, he threatened his stepdaughter, who was in the facility as well. One of the victims apparently stood in front. So, you know, once somebody steps into a public facility, a lot of people and so forth, anything's really possible.
Were there children living in the house? Did they have children together?
Yes. They had one grown child that was, I believe, from an earlier relationship, and then they had a teenager. And she had been in the house, and she was there when the most recent incident happened, and police interviewed her. Sounded like she pretty much came down on her dad's side. But, of course, the interviews sort of happened contemporaneously with her father after the fact. And she was saying that, you know, there was fighting, but again, denied that there was any physical interaction. But her mother's face was all beat up. And they claim that, you know, she had somehow bruised her face on the wall, or, you know, something sticking out of the wall was how this had happened.
Let's put your earphones on. We'll take a couple of phone calls for you. We're speaking this part of the program with John Diedrich, who's been doing extensive reporting on the horrendous shootings and killings at the mall in Brookfield on Sunday of this week, just a couple days ago, just on the heels of another horrendous shooting. It must be hard to cover this again, 6 weeks after the Sikh temple?
Yeah, it's so recent.
Yeah. Kathleen in Milwaukee, hello.
Dishonorably discharged. What was his job in the military? And would he have, had he served overseas, where he would have been a candidate for medical and psychological treatment, possibly for post-traumatic stress disorder? That there was a state law or some kind of law that said that in any kind of case of domestic abuse, that one party is to be taken away. And that had not been followed in the Jeffrey Dahmer case in this car accident in Sipton. So I'm mixing two different things here, but one I thought was a standing law, which it sounds like was not obeyed by the Brown Deer Police Department.
John?
Yeah, Kathleen, those are great questions, both. Let me start with the first one. He is a former Marine. Had occurred, and then either if one of the following had happened, they have a reasonable basis to believe that it's going to be continued, or if there's evidence of abuse or an injury. If there was in January of 2011, there was no apparent injury. There certainly was abuse. There was evidence that there was fighting and so forth in the area. But really, at that point, as these experts have pointed out, unlike later, where in the later incident where there was evidence of an injury, really in the standoff situation, it wasn't really a close call, because once he pointed what appeared to be a weapon out the window, you know, you're talking about very brazen felony behavior. You know, and it wasn't as if they needed a witness to swear this. They saw this. Three police officers, and then those are what are called exigent circumstances. At that point, you know, people I've talked to said, you don't need a search warrant. You can go in. Now, you know, it'd probably be prudent to wait for a SWAT team, of course, for safety and so forth. There's no SWAT team called to the scene. It's just sort of baffling. But in this case, the experts I've spoken to said it appeared as though, at least in a couple of these incidents, mandatory arrest was warranted. But in the standoff, you know, once he pointed what appeared to be a rifle out the window, you know, that really then, you know, moved it into a different category.
Yeah. Let's go to Matt. Matt is in Wausau. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I went to high school with Radcliffe, and I don't know what happened to him since I knew him in the 80s to make him so angry, but I want to point out that it was way too easy for this man to get a gun. If gun stores per se have laws that look into someone's background, perhaps private sales need such thing also. Way too easy to get a weapon.
Where did you go to high school, Matt?
Glenbrook South in Glenview, Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. He had lived in Illinois for a while. What kind of person was he when you knew him? Did you know him very well?
I knew him pretty well. I mean, we wrestled together. We did some track. He was on the track team. Seemed like a normal guy to me. But the thing that I take away from this is anyone can go on Craigslist. Anyone can put an ad in the paper and sell a weapon to anybody. And maybe this incident is time that we take a look at that.
Do you have any questions for Matt?
Well, thank you for calling in, and I appreciate your comments. What you're referring to is what some refer to as the gun show loophole, and we don't know that he bought the weapon at a gun show, but this is a private sale situation where you're exactly right. There's no requirement to do the background check in the 48-hour. And there are lawmakers who are dealing with that issue anew. I'm curious to know when the last time was that you had seen or talked to Radcliffe. He had posted some things recently.
Oh, goodness. I haven't known him since high school.
Okay.
We graduated high school together, and that was the last I spoke to him.
Okay.
But I did find it kind of shocking. I mean, seemed like a regular guy, but I don't know what happened to him in between the time that I knew him and now, but... Again, I think it's way too easy to get a weapon here. And people will say, he'll find a way to get a weapon. Well, let's make it hard for him to get a weapon. And that's what we didn't do here.
And thank you very much, Matt, unless you have something further, John.
No, thank you for calling.
All right. Thanks, Matt, very much for your call. So what are you investigating now? What do you want to know? Obviously, you want to know why this guy wasn't taken in a lot earlier.
Sure.
Other things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the main thing that we're trying to get it to. And also look at, it's been raised, it's not just to holding him accountable, but also looking at the services that the opportunities that were missed to talk about these services. The experts point out, they said, at a minimum, his behavior on January 2011 probably would have had him under some sort of supervision at this time. And it's really not a stretch to say, had the system held him accountable, things may have turned out differently. But going forward, I think the question is, what sort of training is going on? I mean, in this day and age, that was so baffling to these experts to say, this issue is not new. I mean, we've grappled with this for, decades now. How is it that a police department in a, large metropolitan area, they're not, and Brown Deer is not that small, could be reacting this, this way? The SWAT teams for the county or the Milwaukee are standing by for just this sort of thing. So there's a lot of questions about the police behavior and how training and that will be handled in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much. Excellent reporting.
Thank you.
We'll continue to read you. Thank you. John Diedrich, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering this story since it happened, and he has a front page story today. The title of it is "Totally Unacceptable: Police Failed to Protect Public Officials Say." We continue our conversation. We'll be speaking with the director of the Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee. We will also be speaking with a domestic abuse survivor who had to flee the country that she was living in order to get away from her physically and emotionally, verbally abusive husband. We'll look at how prevalent this is. Obviously, these kinds of dramatic cases are not the norm, but it can lead to this, but it makes you wonder, if you are in a situation where there is domestic violence, how do you respond to something like this? Are you more likely to come forward and say, I need help in my relationship, or does it make you more fearful? Does it embolden the abusers? We continue our conversation, and we'll welcome more of your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder that tomorrow we're going to be broadcasting live from Appleton, Wisconsin, from the History Museum, and we're going to be talking about an exhibit we haven't seen yet. We'll see it today, Leonardo da Vinci Machines in Motion. It's really quite an extraordinary exhibit, recreating life-size operational replicas of 40 of the machines that this Renaissance guy designed. We'll also be talking about the skilled manufacturing worker and if there's a way to get those kinds of jobs back and to train more people for those kinds of jobs, would it help the economy? We continue talking about the horrendous act of violence, the weekend shooting by a husband who killed his estranged wife and bystanders, and it just is a sickening story. The broader issue of domestic violence this hour. How much domestic violence is there? Were there signs here, as we were saying with John, that were so blatant and the police just didn't do their job? Accessibility of weapons, lessening the amount of violence. We'll be talking about all of that the next part of the program. Carmen Petrie is director of the Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee. Sojourner has been around for a long, long time in this city. In 1978, Sojourner Truth House, the first shelter for battered women in Milwaukee, was created by the Women's Coalition and the Task Force on Battered Women, incorporated as a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization, and it has been going ever since. That's quite some time. Carmen, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Good morning, Kathleen.
And also joining us is Nicole. Nicole Warner is her name, and she is a musician. She is also a survivor of domestic abuse, and she is joining us by phone today. Nicole, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Good morning, and thank you so much for doing the show. This is so important.
Yes, it is important, that's for sure. I wonder if you could tell us, just in the horrible aftermath of this horrendous event on Sunday, there are a lot of people who are living in situations mm-hmm. where there is violence in the family. What is the response to this? Does it make more women, and it's mostly women who are abused, come forward and try to seek help, or does it make everybody more afraid and kind of stay in their house and worry that this could happen to them? Carmen?
I think the response is probably both. At Sojourner, we serve about 10,000 people a year, and we we serve another 19,000 on our hotline each year, and that's been pretty consistent. We believe two things. It's important for all of us to be talking. We need to be talking more about this issue and how do we prevent it and intervene long before we have to have a criminal response. We also are afraid that some of what is happening actually deters people from coming forward. So we have both concerns. We're grateful about the awareness and the opportunity to have more conversation, but we want to get the message out that it's safe and it's private and you can come forward in confidence.
People are going to hear that number and say, are you serious? 10,000 a year and 19,000 calls?
Absolutely.
This is a huge issue.
It is. And we believe that only 8 to 10%, national studies show only 8 to 10% of people ever come forward, which means that far more people in our community are trying to survive by whatever means they can, long before they turn to us for help. You know, some studies say that incidents happen 7, 8, 9 times before a woman will call the cops or reach out for help. So it's a significant issue. It's been a long-term issue. We should be concerned about children's exposure because they're learning that love and violence go together.
What would you, I want you to comment on the recent case, which is very much front and center. Indications are that domestic violence incidents had gone way back to the year 2000 mm-hmm. and that Zena called the police but then would deny that abuse had taken place. There have been calls for the Brown Deer Police Department to be much more forthcoming about why they didn't take action against this person, what the police response should have been. Two questions. How could this go on for such a long period of time, 12 years, without everybody being able to be moved to safety?
I think it's important to understand that these are complicated cases and people don't come forward for very valid reasons. And our position is we don't experience people as uncooperative. We experience people as trying to survive and trying to keep themselves safe. So the pattern, the long-term pattern, is familiar to us. If you talk to the clients that we see, they would describe the same pattern. Not every perpetrator is as lethal as Radcliffe, the person who did the shooting on Sunday, but there's a large percentage of our clients that are struggling with this same long-term pattern of violence. We also find a significant number of our clients, both survivors and perpetrators, have early exposure to violence. Mm. They saw it as children. They experienced it in their homes. Not every person who grows up in a violent home will live it out, but there is a significant connection. So this pattern is familiar. I use the word, we struggle with people describing her as uncooperative. We do not understand that to be an element that should be considered when a mandatory arrest is being made. It's not something that is familiar to us. We believe that we lost an opportunity when he wasn't brought into custody, as your previous speaker was saying. We lost an opportunity to give him some help to change, you know, and an opportunity to change his behavior before the shooting happened. I'm not a law enforcement officer. I do a lot of training and I do a lot of partnership. And I think it's important that we be as vigorous as we can in holding people accountable.
Nicole, what happened to you?
In very short, it was a very long period of like introduction into the relationship. It was very dramatic from the very beginning. There was a lot of back and forth. And eventually when I call him my faux husband because he's my ex-faux husband. He wasn't a real loving person. We got married, and the first thing that I did was I up and moved to Germany with him because he's German. And I have to state that that doesn't matter that he's German. He could have been American. He could have been from somewhere in South America. The whole dynamic is the same. So we got married, and I was immediately isolated, and we went to this small town. I was thousands of miles away from my family. And he had claimed that that was the only place that he could that he was sure that he could get a job. So, you know, and that's where the pattern starts, is this isolation. There was a lot of drama in the relationship. We got married anyway. And over 4 years, the first 4 years, we were married for five, there was a lot of, you know, a fight. There was a honeymoon period, this totally, like, casebook pattern, like Carmen talked about. There's this honeymoon period where he's really nice, and then there's this tension building, and then there's an incident of abuse. And it's like every time he's, you know, he would try to get me a little bit more unsettled in myself, a little bit more unsettled, a little bit more unsettled. It was a very slow process of getting me to stop trusting myself. And after 4 years, we moved to a large city. We moved to Frankfurt, Germany. And that was when it started to get really bad, because for him, I had access to things. I had a job. I was working more. I actually had several jobs. I still didn't have any money because he spent it all, and it was so bad that he would come home at night and I would hear his key in the door and I would jump about 3 inches off my feet.
Oh.
And it was a very, very slow process. He had he was not particularly physically violent, however, he was still physically violent. He would intimidate me with looks. And that could be in a room full of people. We could have been at a party with 20 people, and I would get that look, and I knew I was going to get it emotionally later. There was going to be a fight. Or I was in the bathroom once, and this was towards the end. This was shortly before I left him. And he said something to me, and I looked at him, and I said, and I could somehow feel my backbone coming back to me, and I said, "I am not afraid of you." And he looked like he was a little puppy, and I had just batted him across the face. It was the weirdest thing. He did something very violent, which was to block me in a room. And I responded with strength, and he backed away. And that, I just find that to be highly unusual. Typically, an abuser will, you know, go in again and get me to back down, but he didn't for some reason.
Hmm. And at what point did you decide you just had to leave? And for you, it was leaving the country, right?
Yes, I was actually in Wisconsin. I was visiting my parents, and I was, after 5 years of marriage, I was visiting my parents alone for the first time, which is another big red flag.
Mm-hmm.
And I was here, and I'd been reading about abuse, and I'd gotten the Lundy Bancroft book, which for me is like, you know, one of my main resources. Why does he do that? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men. And I was at my parents. I'd gone to the library, and I checked it out, and I hid it in my closet so that nobody knew that I would have it because it was still such a big secret.
Mm.
And I was reading in the book, and I was at home, and my mom had gone out to run some errands, and I was alone in the house, and I just thought, I have to call. I have to call. And it took me like 5 or 6 tries to actually pick up the phone and call the National Domestic Violence Hotline. And when I did, the first question that the woman asked me, her name is Ella, she said, "Are you in a safe place?" And I just burst into tears and I said, "I'm so scared." Mm-hmm. And we talked and she said, "You know, if you think your parents would help you, you know, talk to them. Because if you think your parents are really going to help you leave, and it's international, and my ex was going to be in the States anyway because he was supposed to come meet me, and then I was going to go back and work, and he was going to stay here for a little bit of his own vacation." And I talked to them, and I made this plan with my parents, and somehow we survived this week with him together. And the next week, he was here, and my dad and my brother kept him very busy, and I was in Germany packing up my stuff. And I put it on a ship. I had a piano that I put in storage there. I didn't know if I was ever going to see it again. It was the only thing that I owned. And I got on a plane, and I came back to the United States, and then I hid from him for years.
I feel tense just hearing these stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, to have to live that way for all these years, how can you function?
Right. You know, a couple of the points that she made are also familiar to us. This pattern of isolation, which begins subtly at the beginning of the relationship, but gets more and more, victims describe being more and more isolated from friends and family. That's actually a tactic that's used, and it works very effectively. And it sort of keeps victims caught in this cycle of violence, which is the second thing that she described, this honeymoon tension and crisis phase. There was a researcher, Lenore Walker, who termed that cycle the cycle of violence. And it's important to understand it because the more we understand the cycle, the more we can be helpful and more effective in intervening and helping people who are in that pattern and who are trapped. As you said, you and I can barely even listen to it. It's just so stressful and hurtful. So lots of people have described that same pattern that she just did. And then the other tactic, there are many that abusers use, but one is restricted access to finances, which really, if you think about it, limits your options. So he took her to another country, you know, and got her extremely isolated from family and friends who could effectively intervene and help her. And this happens over and over and over. It's a repeated pattern that we see and have seen since we've been studying domestic violence. She also mentioned Lundy. He is in West Bend today doing a training.
Who is this?
Lundy Bancroft. You want to talk about him, Nicole?
Yeah absolutely. He is, he works with like abusers group. So a lot of typically men, they sometimes are court ordered. Sometimes they can voluntarily go into a group and they, you know, they have a men's group that's about trying to learn nonviolent behavior. I heard a statistic once. It was from somebody, I think it was from the Wisconsin Coalition on Domestic Violence. They said 0.5% of abusers actually change. And I really, really hope that that number is higher. But there are so many of these groups that they can be studied. And he's, it says in his bio here, he spent, you know, probably like 20 years now. He specializes in domestic abuse and the behavior of abusive men. And he wrote this book, and it goes through the types of abusers. It goes through their tactics. And one of the things that I find so helpful about this book is that it gives you names, and it gives you terms, and it gives you language to name what an abuser is doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's very empowering.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Lundy's been articulating his research, and his work is very important for all of us in understanding. We run a batterers treatment program. We founded the first Beyond Abuse, the first batterers treatment program in Milwaukee. The power and control wheel, the tactics that she just mentioned, are, you know, ways of understanding battering behavior. So the power and control wheel is a piece that we use to help people understand what's happening in these relationships, the intimidation. As she said earlier, I don't have to beat you every day, but if I give you a look across the room, it has the same impact, same effect. Your property, killing the pets, hurting the pets because it's a way to control you, threatening to hurt the kids, hurting the kids, isolation, getting the survivor to blame and minimize and take on the responsibility for the abuse is a tactic. So these are well-documented pieces that Lundy trains on across the nation, and it's important for us to understand it if we want to be effective in intervening in situations in our communities.
Let's go to some calls. Sheena in Westfield. Hi, Sheena.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I'm calling regarding this, and I'm seeing very many parallels here with my personal experience. I was in a domestically abusive relationship for approximately 7 years, and what mostly kept me in that relationship was, number one, the control of money, and I think that is huge. I am a self-employed person, and every time I would get a large project, he would do something to physically hurt me so I couldn't work. That was very mm-hmm. tough. And then also another thing that I found was that his family made large excuses for him. Mm-hmm. Sheena's just pushing his buttons. She's pushing his buttons. Mm-hmm. So it made the abuse excusable, like I deserved it. So if I stood up to him and I was hurt, it was okay because I did something to instigate it. And I find that very interesting. You know, when I finally went to leave and I did file a restraining order against him, it was very difficult because the police did tell me, you know, we can have this piece of paper, but it does not prevent him from hurting you. If somebody wants to hurt you, they are going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very open with that. And even after the restraining order, the harassment continued. It continued through friends of his. I had my vehicle vandalized. He would park several blocks away from where I was living and walk back and forth in front of my house across the street, you know, within bounds of the within the restraining order. And then eventually he was actually able to, he took out, I feel very vindictively, a restraining order against me to keep me out of local areas where I wanted to go, where I would go. So even still after I left the relationship, after the restraining order was in place, there were still tactics that were used to, you know, intimidate me. And, you know, and it's really hard. And it took me a long time to come forward because of my sense of pride. You know, it's like I'm a strong woman. I'm a smart woman. You know, why? It was embarrassing to me to be going through this. And I felt that leaving the relationship made it seem like I had failed. You know, I was living, you know, I grew up in Iowa, so I was living, you know, hundreds of miles away from home, not a very good supportive, you know, nuclear family system with my mother and father. And it was very difficult. It was a lot of limitations. And I see a lot of parallels there. And it's very scary for women.
Carmen and Nicole, I'd like for both of you to respond. Does that resonate with you, Nicole?
That she brought up that his family supported him and blamed her. Mm-hmm. That was exactly my experience with his friends.
Mm.
When I left, they started telling me that, you know, all of these weird things that he wanted to do, that should have been okay with me because that was what he wanted. And I was literally told that it was probably just 5 years of misunderstandings.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, 5 years, and he's already threatened to kill me three times.
Mm-hmm.
That's not okay with me.
I think as a community, as a society, we're all too often very willing to blame the victim. And I think we do it in subtle and very direct ways, both in families and communities. And it's something we need to deal with as a society, because the blame is not, as I said, that's one of the reasons why we don't talk about clients being uncooperative, because that doesn't matter. The focus should be on why do people feel like they have the right to control their partners and be violent. That's the question we need to explore. I often get asked, why does she stay? It's the most common question people ask us. And, you know, both the caller and Nicole described elements of why people get trapped in these situations. Love, money, fear of financial, you know, not having financial access to resources, fear for your own life. The harassment often does not stop when you leave the relationship. And as the caller described, we don't live in a society where we can police people 24 hours a day.
Right.
So it's a very complicated, we do a process that we call safety planning, and our greatest obligation is to help survivors understand that they're going to be navigating their safety at times on their own, because the cops can't always get there quickly enough, and we can't put you know, there's realities to life that we can't control often. And if you have an abuser who's going to follow up with the threat, we're constantly trying to prevent that homicide from happening. And the safety planning process is critical. And getting people out of isolation and connected to helpful resources. The workplace can be one of those, family, friends, church. But we need to, as a community, make all of ourselves more educated and more we need to understand the dynamics and being willing to hold people accountable at an earlier phase before we need criminal intervention.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. Responding to domestic violence over the weekend, the horrendous act in Brookfield, and looking at the extent, the huge extent of this problem in our community and in our world, actually. We have two guests with us. Carmen Petrie, director of Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee. Nicole Warner is also joining us. She is a domestic abuse survivor. 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. And you can always use our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, the author of From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Michael Klarman will be joining us. Michael became interested in the whole topic after he wrote a book about Brown v. the Board of Education, so he has that historical perspective. More phone calls. Annette in the North Woods. Hi, Annette.
Hello. I'm real concerned about putting the blame on the police department and putting the blame on other people. When a victim comes forward, I'm a former battered woman from Wisconsin, and I put a 4-year restraining order on my abuser, and he violated it 4 times, and I stayed in isolation for 3 years. These shelters need to have the proper basic care. They need to have the support of Wisconsin. So when I go there, other women go there, that we have a support group of other women that feel like I did, instead of being in isolation. I went from isolation into more isolation because I was told that paper is only good as what it was written on it, and it isn't the police department's job to babysit me. What I needed was education of why he did this to me. He said he loved me. And so I guess what I'm saying is that we keep educating and educating, but are we doing the basics? Are we making sure these shelters have enough rooms for victims like myself? Are we making sure that they're doing their group participation with the victims? That woman reached out, and she didn't have anybody hearing her. She wouldn't have kept reaching out. And that's what concerns me, that we're focusing on the abuser and not on this cycle of abuse for us. I needed someone to explain to me why the man that loved me tried to kill me.
Carmen.
I think she's right about the blame. For me, I don't think that blaming anyone in these instances is helpful. We need to look for opportunities to do better and be better. And she's absolutely right. We have shelters all over the state that are raising money privately, and we get government grants as well. But we need a strong infrastructure for victim services across the state, not just at Sojourner. You know, we raise $1.7 million privately, and we get some government grants. But we need to have strong, viable services available every time a woman or a man who's being abused steps forward. It's not any one person's responsibility to babysit anyone, but we have a role and a responsibility. We have a role to play in making sure that people are safe and accountable. We need strong treatment programs. We need strong support groups, strong, viable shelters, services for children. I do think we have that infrastructure. I don't think it's perfect. And I do think we all miss opportunities to do what we can for families and survivors.
How could it be perfect? Look at the enormity of the problem. My gosh.
It's significant.
Huge numbers of people. Let's talk about the law a little bit more, because several people have mentioned restraining orders. What is the law in the state of Wisconsin? And would you share the concern that was voiced by our first guest, the reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about the police department, mandatory arrest, not arresting somebody who clearly was pointing what may have been a gun through a window, and all kinds of incidents that make you wonder, why in the world wasn't somebody arrested? Mm-hmm. What is the mandatory arrest policy? How good are restraining orders? Do we need some other element of the law to keep somebody from going to a salon and murdering people?
You know, I'm a supporter of law enforcement. I partner with them. I've done training for years, and I certainly do not want to suggest that they're out there doing the wrong thing. I think law enforcement all too often is left holding these really complicated situations with very little resources, which is the other thing we need to do better. We need to support our departments and giving them the resources they need to intervene. They're often called to the scene, and they have to act as social workers as well as do their law enforcement role. Good things, but we need to give them more resources. So, and I'm also not in a position to criticize Brown Deer for what they did or didn't do. I think the facts are coming forward. What I understand about mandatory arrest and why it's so important is before 1980s, 1986 was when the pro-arrest policy started to get adopted across the country and in Wisconsin. 1989 was when the law was passed. My understanding of the law is before that, law enforcement did not have the obligation to arrest. Now that we have this mandatory arrest law, if an officer determines that they have probable cause that a crime's been committed and it fits the definition of domestic violence, which is a crime that's committed between two people who live together in the past or have a child in common, they have an obligation to determine who the primary aggressor was and arrest that person and bring them in so the DA's office can review and make a charge or make a decision. That's a basic door that we open in the community for people to get help. We make victims safer by removing that person from the scene, and we give an opportunity for the abuser to get some treatment and make a decision about changing their behavior. So that's my basic understanding of the law. It's critical, it's important, and we're always training officers to understand mandatory arrest and to implement it. Restraining orders, you know, a lot of people say, well, it's just a piece of paper. And for us, it's a very important piece of paper. Last year, we saw 5,031 people in our restraining order clinic. We saw 1,000 of those people were men. So we do know that men are being hurt and violated and abused, and they do come forward, not in the same numbers, but they do come forward. Restraining orders put up a protective barrier between you and the person who wants to hurt you. So it's the first thing a law enforcement professional will probably ask on the scene is, do you have a restraining order? Or they will tell you, go get a restraining order. Because it makes it a criminal offense for you to contact me before you batter me, mm-hmm. as well as trying to contact me through a third party. It's not perfect. There's many instances where law enforcement cannot get on the scene quick enough. So we need to do better, but these are important tools and strategies in survivors' lives.
Oh, we were out of time. Nicole, what's your website for people to learn more about you?
My website is NicoleWarner.com, and if you hover over About, you will see a drop-down menu. It'll say Personal, and you can read more about my story there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thanks, Nicole, for your courage.
Yeah, and Carmen, thank you so much for being with us. Carmen Petrie is director of the Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee, which has been in existence, the first shelter for battered women in Milwaukee, 1978. Nicole Warner is a domestic abuse survivor. She is also an extremely talented musician and singer. And she has a website that has her music and also her her story. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. We will continue and have an interesting second hour of the program as well. This is the Ideas Network.